Well, thank you for having me here this morning. It's great to be with you and back in South Australia after a year or so being away. It's been wonderful to connect with people. I see a few familiar faces out there, particularly those of you connected to the King's School where my kids used to attend as well. It's great to be here. It was about 30 years ago now where the whole issue of poverty really hit me square between the eyes in quite a surprising way that I wasn't expecting. Here I was in the Philippines. We were actually going to America on a trip for my brother's wedding. We dropped in at the Philippines on the way through to do nothing else but to experience another country's culture and do the whole tourist thing. Now, this was in the late 80s where the country had been doing it pretty tough. They were on the end of a pretty severe economic recession at the time, although you wouldn't know because you had to sift through a city that seemed to have everything that they needed. There's a lot of hustle and bustle and lots of images promoting wealth around Manila. And here we were on this tour of central Manila. And just on the edge of the city, I witnessed this huge discrepancy between the rich and the poor. We were on this bus tour and travelling through this outer suburb. And on one side of the street, you had a whole lot of grand homes and palaces, huge places. And on the other side of the very same street, you had little tin sheds for homes. You had young children walking around with no clothing on, looking aimless, kicking around screwed up pieces of newspaper for makeshift soccer balls and not in school. And I couldn't understand how there could be such a discrepancy on the very same street. And it was as if God was saying to me as I looked at the rich side of the street over here, I sensed him say to me, "Hey Mark, that's where you live. That's your side of the street." I remember feeling quite uncomfortable, even maybe a little bit guilty, as I looked at the rich side of the town. I really rocked my then middle-class suburban, eastern suburban lifestyle there in Melbourne. I didn't know what to do with this. Watching the families on the rich side and the poor side of the street both fascinated me and challenged me. And for the first time in my life, I got a very different perspective on God's world. And that unease continued as we travelled through other regions. We saw families living in waste dump areas for homes and up in the hills where we saw beggars in the streets and unmade roads and exposed wires and obvious poverty up there in their more regional outposts as well. My eyes were now open to a very different world to that that I experienced at that point in my life. I wonder if you've ever had a moment in time like that, an experience like that where poverty has hit you between the eyes. It's been quite confronting for you, whether it be a local context, whether it be a global context. How did you respond? What sort of emotions were going on for you? Maybe it was quite pointed. See, Scripture presents a vision of the world as a place where all people can share in the abundance of the earth. And not just in the abundance of the earth, but the comfort, nurture, and support of a loving community. Now, poverty deprives people of the opportunity of experiencing those things. Extreme poverty is disturbing. It's even more disturbing when you're confronted by its reality, as I was in the Philippines all those years ago. Now, poverty is a part of this world that we do know. It is what it is. It was not God's intention, but due to the inequities of this world and certainly the selfishness of many nations and people groups, God's world is hurting. But if you listen just carefully enough, and you do have to listen carefully and sift through all the hustle and bustle and the noise of the society that we live in, if you listen carefully, you might just hear the cries of the poor over the cries of our own flesh and over the cries of our self-centered society. And let me say categorically, the hunger, the pain, the deprivation, the injustice, it is real. And although we can sometimes become a little desensitized to it, if you just open up your eyes and your ears, and most importantly, your hearts, you can't help but be gripped by its reality. And the reality is this. Have a look at the screen there. And I'll just do a bit of a scattergun here and just show you what the up-to-date statistics are when it comes to extreme poverty around the world. In the world today, 836 million people still live in extreme poverty. 663 million people do not have access to a protected water source, so most of those people are poor and they live in rural areas. 2.4 billion people lack access to basic sanitation services such as toilets. Now, most of us have probably got two or three toilets in our homes. Nearly half of all deaths in children under five are attributable to undernutrition. That translates into the unnecessary loss of about 3 million young lives a year. Over 1,400 young children die each day, or about 526,000 children a year, from diarrhoea, despite the availability of simple and effective treatment. And you know here in Australia just how simple and effective that treatment is. 124 million children and adolescents throughout the world are missing school. An estimated 75 million children have had their education disrupted via crisis and conflict. Then globally, one in nine people in the world today, 795 million, are undernourished. So that is the reality, the global reality as we speak. But what about here at home? Because many of you are connecting with people throughout the week who are suffering at a variety of levels, whether that be unemployment, whether that be financial stress or loneliness or family breakdown or harmful addictions or domestic violence. And the needs range from food to employment to clothing to educational resources to health issues to furniture. People who are often looking not just for a helping hand, not just for a couple of bucks out of our pocket, but for someone to come alongside of them and show them some worth, just to love them, to show them some self-respect, or give them some self-respect. You know, one of the great things about being part of a church community like this here at King's is that we get to be attentive to each other's needs. When one of us fall on hard times or go through an impoverished season of life, we get around each other, don't we? Brothers and sisters in Christ, we do what we do best, and we care for each other. We provide practical assistance to each other when needed. It's a wonderful part about being the church. But of course, it has to go beyond just us, doesn't it? God's called us to bless the community that we're a part of here in Tea Tree Gully. And so we extend ourselves beyond this border into those borders and bless those who are doing it tough, that have fallen on hard times. But then again, beyond those borders again, as we look into the global sphere as well, into a hurting and very needy world. It's overseas and it's on our doorstep. And God is asking us to listen, to hear his call to bless the poor. Now, we can shut ourselves off from that call. That's not hard to do, particularly in the society that we do live in. Or we can embrace the plight of the poor and respond with compassion and mercy, which is exactly what Nehemiah did in the Bible verses we're going to have a very quick look at this morning. Let me give you some context to our reading this morning. Nehemiah, he was the third great leader in the Jewish restoration. First of all, you had Zerubbabel coming along in 538 BC. And he brings the first group of exiles back to Jerusalem. And with that, he supervises the building of the temple. Now, 80 years after that comes Ezra. Ezra the scribe brings a whole lot of sweeping reforms based around the ministry of God's word. And some good things happen, but in times things degenerate. And so 13 years after that comes Nehemiah. And Nehemiah was burdened by God about the conditions that Jerusalem were experiencing at the time. Nehemiah was needed. The Jerusalem wall was in ruins. And so the king gives Nehemiah permission to rectify a few things. He knew that he had to come up with a plan, and that plan was to rebuild the city walls. He also knew that it was imperative that those city walls be rebuilt for the sustenance, but also the repairing of the city. If that city was to survive and thrive, those walls would need to be built. And so with that, he provides the sort of quality leadership that Israel desperately needed at the time. Now, there's much to learn from the story of Nehemiah. It's a very well-known story. A lot of you know it already. But I want to reflect just briefly on one small element of the story which came about during the building project. We could look at a whole lot of things around leadership principles and building projects and standing up to the negative voices coming in. But there was one small element of the story I'd like us to focus on this morning. While the rebuild was in full swing, an ugly internal problem arose. Let me read from Nehemiah chapter 5. Verses 1 to 5 there for us. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, "We've had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have had to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." That word powerless is a crucial word when it comes to those who are stuck in poverty. When you're stuck in poverty, you often feel powerless. Why? Because, number one, I haven't been educated. I don't even know how to get myself out of the predicament I'm in. Secondly, I have been squashed so much by those around me that I just feel like I'm a hopeless case. And I don't have people speaking up on my behalf around me. No one's advocating for me. So that word powerless is a crucial word when it comes to understanding poverty. So in this context, what you've got here is you've got the poor of Jerusalem rising up in protest against the oppressive practices of their rich cousins. So they're complaining about food shortages and hunger and inflation, all those sorts of things, and how some families were driven to the extreme measure of selling their own flesh and blood, their own children, into slavery. And it's still happening today. And the people, quite rightfully so, were saying, enough is enough. Someone please help us. See, the place was a mess. Jerusalem was a mess at the time. And fortunately, the people that were certainly experiencing hardship, they found someone who was willing to listen. And it comes in the form of Nehemiah. We pick up our verse here, verse 6. When I heard their outcry, Nehemiah said, and these charges, I was very angry. Then on to verse 9. What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God? Give back to them immediately their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. And also the usury that you are charging them. The 100th part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil. You see, when Nehemiah becomes aware of the plight of the people, he becomes angry. It's what you would describe and define as a righteous anger. Now, what infuriated him was not that they were going through tough times. All economies go through their ups and downs. What infuriated him was that some people were taking advantage of those who were desperately in need, who were powerless. And so he gets to challenging their selfishness and works to restoring some equity and some fairness, and does so with a huge dose of humility and compassion. You see, Nehemiah provides us with a great example. When you and I are confronted by the cries of the poor, whether that be local, whether it be global, he does three things. He listens, he discerns, and then he responds. It's a great model for us to follow too when we're confronted by the cries of the poor. Let's have a quick look at those three things. The first one is that he listens. See, amidst the busyness and the focused work that Nehemiah was involved in, we read there in verse 6, I heard their outcry. In other words, he really listened to them, which is not always easy to do when you are busy, when you've got a whole lot of set agendas. I know in my life how easy it is for me to turn a blind eye to the cries of the poor and certainly block my ears to the cries of the poor. Why? Because I'm too busy. I can justify not having to respond to the cries of the poor because I'm busy enough in of itself in my life. So I can easily walk past those who are crying out for a bit of attention, those who are crying out who are in injustice, those who have been marginalised, ostracised in our society. I can ignore them quite comfortably. Why? Because I've got my own plans. I've got my own business to look after. If you're like me, you might be a little task-orientated. And through the week, you're ticking off your little boxes and you're not satisfied till they're all ticked. And nothing in out there is going to encroach on those boxes until I've got them all ticked. And so we get very tunnel vision sometimes and we don't hear the cries of the poor and we haven't even got eyes for the poor. Sometimes we can become desensitized too, can't we? Because the images are so prevalent now through social media and reporters overseas in all of these nations. We see the stories, we hear the stories, we see the images of injustice. But we see them so often, it's almost like it's become fiction to us now. It just rolls off the back and it stops. It doesn't affect us like it used to. Nehemiah, if anyone had an excuse not to hear the cries of the poor, at least not to have to respond to them, would be Nehemiah. What a huge task he's got on his hands here. I mean, the nation's future depends on his leadership. He's got scores of people that he's leading, lots of challenges and negative voices being thrown in, a vision that God's given him to fulfill. If anyone had an excuse just to stay focused, the task at hand, it would be Nehemiah. Yet he still had ears for the poor. He believed that the cries of the poor deserved attention, even though he was busy, even though he had focused work to do, just like you and I. Second thing he did was discern. So he's got to hear their complaint, doesn't he? But first of all, he's got to work out whether it's a fair complaint. These guys just sort of slinging off, are they having a bit of a whinge? Are they a bit like the half glass empty type of person, just always whinging about things? Or is it genuine? So he's got to discern whether the actual complaint is a genuine complaint here, or whether they're just crying poor to receive some attention or a little bit of money and resource. And that's a challenge for all of us, isn't it? Because there is a constant cry for help from so many charitable organisations and individuals today, isn't there? Can I or should I respond to all of them? I'd like to. Is the cry for help an honest one, or am I being taken for a sucker? They're all the sort of things that we've got to negotiate, aren't they? It's important that we're careful, that we're prayerful when responding to the cries of the poor and discerning what specific action God is calling us to. I know as a church you're very prayerful in terms of where you collate your resources and send them to in terms of local and global needs. That's to be commended. In our own lives too, we ought to be just as prayerful. We can't respond to every presenting need because the need is not always the call. What we can do though is grow a heart of compassion, ready to respond when God does call and present a clear opportunity, perhaps to step into somebody else's story. Defaulting to compassion will always have you more aligned with God's heart than defaulting to cynicism and judgment. Let me say that again. See, defaulting to compassion, love and mercy will always have you more aligned with God's heart than defaulting to judgment and cynicism. The third thing he does, he responds. Now, that's the simple thing, by all accounts, but really that's the hardest thing to do, isn't it? You can listen to the cries of the poor. You can discern whether those cries are genuine and are needy. But then it takes courage to actually step in and respond. And that's what Nehemiah does. In verse 9 there, he says, "Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God?" So this response of Nehemiah's shows a real reverence towards God here. So Nehemiah is suggesting that the people's selfish actions are a sign of disrespecting God, and that their reverence towards God would be seen in their compassion and in their help to those who are less fortunate. Therefore, what you glean from this passage here, and I'm not sure if you've ever made this connection, but how we respond to the plight of the poor is actually a measure of our reverence towards God. And I love his response here, Nehemiah. I'm a practical person, so I really relate to this. Notice that he doesn't put down his tools when he responds to the plight of the poor. He keeps rebuilding the walls. He fulfills the vision that God's put before him. But now he does so with a merciful edge, with an eye on the needs of others, which is relevant for us today, isn't it? Ministry in the church doesn't stop. A lot of you are involved in a lot of cutting edge and programmatic ministries and initiatives that are having a huge effect on people's lives for eternity. Certainly not saying, close them down. Shut it all down. Be attentive to this voice over here. It's just that we approach our ministry now with a more open gaze, a more compassionate, merciful gaze. Yes, we might be busy. We might have a vision that God's put before us that we're attentive to, but we've still got ears and eyes for what's going on outside of that, particularly with the poor. I call that peripheral vision. God's often implanted on me. There have been times in my life where I've needed to open up my gaze. You heard earlier that Mike and I are chaplains in the AFL world, and that's a real privilege. And I digress for a moment. Pray for him, won't you? That's a real privilege to be involved in local chaplaincy, to be involved in Adelaide Crows. That's a huge privilege because he is actually connecting with players and staff down there, and their only connection with the church or any sort of pastoral connection, spiritual connection they will have is Mike. And that's it. And you need to pray for him. It's an incredible opportunity that he has in that club, as I've got at Essendon as well. Some of the conversations that you have are conversations you don't get to have anywhere else as a pastor. But when you're in the raw environment of footy club, boy, and you get to build relationships, doors open, conversations open. And it's a wonderful opportunity to be the hands, the feet, importantly, the mouthpiece of Jesus. So pray for him, won't you, in that. But Mike and I, we get to see these great footballers each week. One of the things that separates the great footballers from just the good footballers is peripheral vision. That ability to know what's happening all the way around you, not just what's in front of you. So when the great players receive the football, they know how to distribute it and where to distribute it before they don't have to look there. They know what's happening around them. It's an uncanny sense that they have. And things almost happen in slow motion around them as they just sort of walk through traffic and then disperse the ball wherever they need to. It's a great gift that some of the greatest players have been given. God has often impressed on me, hey Mark, open up your peripheral vision. You're just tunnel vision. You're only seeing what's in your diary. You're only seeing what's in front of you. what this week entails. Mark, open up your peripheral vision, because there are stories are unfolding all around you where God's already at work that I'm inviting you to step into. But you're too busy about worrying about yourself and your own stuff to step into those things. And so you miss out on the gift that God's actually giving us and inviting us into. And often those stories are people who are stuck in poverty or feeling powerless or marginalised. And they're stories that are there ready for us to be involved in. It's a wonderful part of being involved in God's work when you open up your heart to what he's doing around us and the mystery of what God does around us and being invited to step into those mysteries. It's a wonderful part of the adventure of being with Christ. In his response, Nehemiah here, he gives us a great example to follow. So he refuses to live the life of luxury that he was actually entitled to in his position. Instead, he hosts people at his dinner table. He refuses to make money out of his position. He refuses to lord it over others. He was more interested in God and God's most prized possession, people. That's what drove Nehemiah. It wasn't the wall that was driving him. As important as that task was, it was the people. If you look at Jesus, I could have preached many messages about Jesus and his interaction with the marginalised and the hurting and the ostracised. And time again, you read in the scriptures in the New Testament where Jesus had pity on them. Jesus had compassion for them. And that's what drove him in his interaction with people. He couldn't help but bless people who were being cast aside, who were doing it tough, who were feeling powerless. And of course, his ulterior motive was to bless them physically, relationally, and then step them in to spiritual awakening into eternity through his mercy, through his grace. So look at the way those who had offended and treated the poor in our story this morning, those that had treated people harshly, look at the way they respond there in verse 12. "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." At this, the whole assembly said amen and praised the Lord, and the people did as they had promised. That's the sort of response that God is looking for today from his people. For Australian Christians, we must view our response to the poor as an integral part of our Christian discipleship. And I'm not preaching a theology of works here this morning. Understand that I believe that word and deed complement each other. They are aligned, both very valid expressions of the gospel, working in together. Proclamation and demonstration, coming together and seeing lives transformed for the better. See, in a world where more than 1 billion people live in extreme poverty, the way we respond to this is central to how we fulfill God's call to love our neighbour. And we're seeing progress around the world. This is the wonderful news. Since the year 2000, when Australia was involved in those Millennial Development Goals, which have now been changed to the Sustainable Goals here in 2015. Since that time, over 1 billion people have overcome the obstacle of extreme poverty around the world. That is great news. You know, in that time, the last 20 years, child mortality has halved. So back in the late 1990s, 12 million children under the age of 5 were dying each year of a preventable disease. Now it's 5.9 million. Still way too many. That's an incredible reduction in child mortality. 90% of the world now has access to safe drinking water. You couldn't say that 20 years ago. So we are seeing the trend line starting to move in the right direction. But as you saw by those stats a little earlier in my message here, we still have a long way to go for all people to experience that fullness of life that God intended and created for all people. And there are stories of transformation all around the world just waiting to unfold. You've seen one already. Through young Shanto there in Bangladesh. A wonderful story of transformation in he and his family's life. Let me give you another example, a very practical one in many ways. A few years ago, I visited Nepal with Baptist World Aid. Now, Nepal is one of the poorest countries in the world. You've got the capital city there, Kathmandu. It's dusty, it's dirty, it's chaotic, it's busy. I'm not sure if any of you have been there, but it's a beautiful place in terms of its people, but resource-wise, it's very minimal. And you've got polluted atmosphere and bamboo scaffolding in the streets and exposed wire. And that's quite an incredible place in that way. But the irony is you've got all these advertising billboards in their streets promoting success and wealth and fame, which is a far cry from the majority of the people that live in Nepal, particularly those in the more remote and regional areas where we do most of our work. And I spent some time in one of those areas, found my way into the mountains of Lalitpur, to southeast of Kathmandu. And here's a picture of a mountain here that I was visiting. Now look at that. That's God's country. Beautiful and lush and green. You could retreat there for a week, couldn't you? But unbeknownst to us, looking at that, there are stories of poverty that lie right throughout that mountain. Story after story. We came across this family who'd been living in a makeshift humpy. The daughter was always sick. They couldn't afford to send her to school. They couldn't afford to buy medical supplies for her. They lived in just a dingy little home. Things weren't great for them. Food on the table was very scarce as well. But things changed for them dramatically when they became recipients of a Baptist World Aid community development project. The parents joined a self-help group. They were taught how to rear chickens and run a business effectively and efficiently. So when we approached their home on this particular day to sort of get the back end of their story, we expected to see just a couple of dozen chickens out the back, maybe in a little wire chicken coop. But to our great surprise, we came across two huge sheds, larger than this auditorium, full of free-range chickens with a thriving business that they had learned to run. And with the success of their business, they were able to erect their own home, they were able to send their child to school, they could afford those medical supplies that they needed, food on the table, they could teach others in their community how to run a business just like them. It changed their lives for the better. In ways that you and I might take for granted, but for them, this was Christmas. It all come. And I've got other stories like that, stories of empowerment where whole villages have been lifted out of poverty, as I mentioned earlier. And I've seen things, great outcomes, spiritual outcomes resulted with our work, because of course we work only with Christian organisations on the ground. So seeing baptisms occurring in those communities, connections to the local church, people becoming Christians, churches being planted. You'll see that all around the work that we're involved in around the world as well. Isaiah 1:17. Learn to do right, seek justice and encourage the oppressed. Defend the cause of the fatherless and plead the case of the widow. See, few of us can contemplate hungry children, weeping mothers, despairing fathers, minimal resources. But when we allow ourselves to and become just a little vulnerable, we strip away our own needs and the whole me, me, me society that we're a part of. You can't help but ask, in my privileged position, in my apparent affluence, what can I do? What can I do? And then when faced with the magnitude of world poverty, you might even get to that place that where you're stymied. And you say to yourself, but really, what difference can I make? What difference can one person or one family or one income make, really? Well, I've got to say, you can make a heck of a difference. I remember, again, vividly standing on this next slide on that very mountain. At the top of this mountain, I was standing on this morning talking to one of our Christian workers. And I said to him, mate, how do you do it? How do you get out of bed in the morning with a spring in your step? You know that through this mountain range there is a whole story of poverty. Families stuck in poverty. It must be depressing. It must be so disenchanting for you. How do you do it? He goes, well, Mark, if I looked at it that way, I probably would be pretty depressed, but I don't. I see this as a great opportunity to be the hands, the feet, the mouthpiece of Jesus. And so I get up in the morning feeling privileged that I have an opportunity to see lives being changed through the work that we're doing. And so what we do here at Baptist World Aid, we look at this mountain and we're going to change this mountain. When that mountain has been lifted out of poverty, we'll move to the next mountain. When that mountain's lifted out of poverty, we'll move to the next mountain until the whole mountain range has been lifted out of poverty. My invitation to you today is to join us at Baptist World Aid, but more importantly, join our redemptive God and see the opportunity to affect change. Whether that be one mountain at a time, one community at a time, one family at a time, might be one child at a time, it might even be one shopping trip at a time. Whatever it is for you, whatever God's speaking to your heart right now, have the courage to respond just like Nehemiah did. And that might be different to the person next to you. It may be coming to see me after the service and choosing one of those beautiful children from Cambodia, Philippines, Nepal, wherever it might be, and start to become part of their story. Add a child to your family on this particular day. It might be to start shopping ethically and taking that one a little more seriously. It might be to advocate and speak up for those that can't speak up for themselves. It may be to give generously to someone in need that God's placing on your heart, even though things are a little tight for yourself. But while you're responding, make sure you're reading the scriptures, won't you? Because when you read the scriptures, you'll see God's heart for the poor. You actually can't miss it. Now, it was Rick Warren who once said this. You can go to that next slide. Now, I've got 3 advanced degrees. I've had 4 years in Greek and Hebrew, and I've got doctorates. How did I miss the 2,000 verses in the Bible where it talks about the poor? How did I miss that? I mean, I went to two different seminaries and a Bible school. How did I miss the 2,000 verses on the poor? Well, as you move into this week ahead, take some time, won't you, to listen to God's heart for the poor. Because what you'll find the God who sees the poor, who hears their cry, is filled with compassion for them, is outraged at the injustices visited upon them, and is determined to secure justice for them. And I trust you hear this call to bless the poor, if in fact you haven't heard it already, and join our compassionate, redemptive God in reaching out in mercy to those who are in need.